My panel here really needs no introduction in the interest of brevity, because we are running behind. It was great to have Chris Grundler from EPA here. Clearly, his boss, Gina McCarthy's comments that maybe they didn't get the 2014 RVOs just right is a good sign for our industry. So what we're going to talk about up here today is, where is ethanol's future? I'm glad that the panel ahead of us debunked some of the myths and some of the misinformation that's put out there. When the headlights of your car don't turn on, it's not necessarily ethanol. I did learn last night at dinner it could be the blinker fluid. The gentlemen here are experts, and I am humbled to be attending a lot of meetings and listening to their expertise and their wisdom. So we're going to have our panel up here. Bill, I think we're actually starting off with you.
Thank you, Chrissy, for having me here again. This is my third conference and the second time speaking. And I think the best part, other than this presentation, is the night before, because there's a lot of ethanol-fueled comments there, and it's not all about gasoline, so it's a very, very enjoyable time. So my presentation's a little boilerplate. You know, this presentation, blah, 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 read it, it's okay. It just means we're expressing some potential look-aheads for what's going on, and doesn't necessarily mean that we're talking about future products. So, again, my name is Bill Webkenberg. I'm responsible for fuels in the United States for Mercedes-Benz, and I want to talk about another look at, is there really a blend wall? I mean, Brian West talked about his fuel, the renewable super premium, and I think it's already here. It's called flex fuel. Clean octane, that's my term. So as we say, hopefully this, you drink the best and you burn the rest. So if that's the applause I get for the rest of my day, I'll be really happy. So flex fuel is already here. I mean, some people say it's really not readily available. And so whatever the definition is of readily available, if you look at a lot of population centers, it is around. And if you look at, you know, it's in lots of populous cities. So it could be more places, but it's not only in, you know, three places in the whole world. So it's, the fuel exists. So that kind of issue, once you get customers' appetite whetted for it, I think that'll only improve. If you look at reality, even today, even though the fuel isn't selling beyond the nature of this, flex fuel is on par with gasoline already for a cost per energy basis. So you take into account that E85 is really E80 or E74, and you compare it to E10 instead of E0, you're really only down in energy content about 18%, 19% perhaps, because there's some combustion benefit to running higher blends of ethanol. And then you look at the EIA.gov price for January 2014, it shows that E85 was $2.77 a gallon, and regular was $3.26 a gallon. So on that basis, it's pretty much on par. The definition of flex fuel includes blends all the way down to E51. So if that's the case, you're actually, it closes the gap down to less than 15%, which means you're making money, sort of. And if you compare it to premium fuel, it is an advantage already today. So back again to the discussion of, it's a cheap, renewable, super premium already. So we can't get customers to do the math, but the reality is it is viable today as it's being touted, but it's really not the way I think it should be touted. We know it reduces CO2. My fine colleagues at General Motors, I plagiarized some of their presentations, and more or less it says 30% less carbon. That's well understood, so great information. And you use a bit more of the fuel, so in reality you have about a 5% carbon benefit if you just use E85 straight up. But what it really is, and this is my childhood hero, by the way, it is the best-kept performance secret in the world. And why? So as Brian West knows, and Jim Shebus from Oak Ridge, I'm going to plagiarize from them because they do some great work. So the copy and paste function is well used in my presentation. So right from one of their presentations, if you use the worst case possible octane, which would be straight run gasoline with E51, so lowest ethanol blend, it's still about a 95 pump octane, 95 AKI. It far exceeds our minimum MON, motor octane number requirements, and it's 102 RON, which is what the turbocharged engines really look for. So, in other words, this is a fuel that's as good as or better than the best fuel you get in Europe for these types of engines. So you could comfortably potentially optimize your vehicles on the worst possible case fuel of flex fuel. Now, if you take it all the way up to E85, it's 104 octane, 105 octane. So it's fantastic stuff. And it's free octane because you can't keep reducing the base oxygen blend down to take away octane for other things. At some point, you don't meet the RVP requirements, so and the fuel needs a basic volatility for drivability and whatnot. So you're getting free octane, and you can't get away from that. And why is it better? Once again, shamelessly cribbing from Oak Ridge. If you look at the slide, people ask for horsepower, but they really buy torque. And you look at RPM, 1,200 to about 2,000 RPM, that's your kind of throttle response. Low RPM, tip into the throttle, you get that gratified push in the back as you accelerate. When you can double the torque down there, if you look at for the 100 RON case versus the 90 RON or even the 96 RON, that's diesel territory. And the technologies are actually starting to encroach on each other. Diesels are going down in compression ratio. They enjoy very, very high torque. Gasoline engines are now coming up in compression ratio because of direct injection and other features. And now octane would permit it to start taking on some characteristics like a diesel. So this is where the fun is. It's fun to be at 9,000 RPM until things go boom. But when you drive around all the time, you don't feel like putting your foot into the main bearings every time you accelerate. You just like the fact that I can squeeze the throttle and I can go. And this is what this fuel would permit. So we have a 2-liter gasoline turbocharged direct injected engine on the right. We have a 2.1 liter diesel engine on the left. A little shameless commercial. The diesel engine on the left is really cool because it'll get 45 miles per gallon in a 4,500 pound car. On the right is the 2-liter GTDI Mercedes-Benz engine, and that's typical of the industry right now. And on 95 RON E10, so that's about 91 pump octane in the United States, makes 210 horsepower and 260 foot-pounds. But if you do a little extrapolation and whatnot, you can find out that potentially you can rival it the diesel for torque density. 102 RON engine potentially could make over 350 foot-pounds of torque. And that is really, really fun. And that's low RPM torque. That's not revving the engine to death. That is just usable, everyday torque. So that's the essence of downsizing and downspeeding, is that you don't have to torture the engine. You drive it normally and gently, and you still get gratified. Still further cribbing from Oak Ridge, you can have your cake and eat it. And if you look at the point D that's flashing there, that is the downsize and downspeed line. So at constant power, I can reduce engine RPM. As I reduce engine RPM, I reduce frictional losses, I reduce pumping losses. And I can downsize at constant speed because then also you reduce your specific fuel consumption. And it shows that you can make a small engine do the work of a big V8 of only like 10 years ago. So, and as you do that, you're efficiency goes up, both just generically and also your operating efficiency driving down the road, and it's enabled by higher octane. But so how do you make it cool? Okay, how do you make customers want it? Because right now they don't want it. They aggressively ignore it. That's why I tell my kids if they have something that's bugging them, aggressively ignore it. Well, that's what's happening today. So how do you make it want it? Well, you make them demand it, and like Brian West suggested, It's not a filler fuel. It is a really cool fuel. It's a race fuel. It's a high octane clean fuel. So, but first you got to talk about psychology a little bit. So Lucy's going to talk with Charlie Brown in a second here. People have basic needs. Okay, you need things. You want things. And Maslow's hierarchy of needs means you start off with physiological needs, food, shelter, whatnot. You work your way up to love and then to AMGS, SLS. And then finally, if you do it correctly, you get to demands. Demands are the zenith of your wants. You want the best. And flex fuel could potentially be the best, so why not market it as the pinnacle of your performance fuel desires? Put it at the very top, because that's kind of what it is. It's a very useful fuel that's not being utilized. So how do you market it? Okay, so you go, there's, you have a product and service, you show value, you have a transaction, you develop markets, you then establish and affirm needs and wants. And you've kind of tried to do that with flex fuel today, but it's not really happening. So what do? You create the demand, and just like Brian suggested, look at this. It's octane. It's a 95 AKI minimum fuel any day of the week. It's cheaper octane than even 93, which is typically the highest premium you get. Sometimes you get 94 in certain areas. And it's way cheaper than race gas. And if you can see the presentation, that's $8 a gallon for high aromatic race fuel. And the only benefit to that is that it smells really cool when it's burning. So that's why I have no hair anymore, because I spent too much time around it, apparently. So if you look at the certification fuel, you want to make it the certification fuel for a bunch of turbocharged and supercharged vehicles. All these OEMs make a turbocharged engine or supercharged engine, forced induction, that could certainly benefit from ethanol and higher octane. 250,000 new forced induction vehicles enter the U.S. market each year. That's a growing, sustainable body of vehicles that would use this fuel. You can directly market also. This is just right off the internet. There are aftermarket tuners for E85 vehicles, or for vehicles that were never meant to have E85 in them. There are guys converting their ZR1 Corvettes into flex fuel capable vehicles, 700 horsepower beasts. So that's a shameless commercial for General Motors, and I won't do that again. So you want to make it a super fuel. Make it a clean octane, high octane fuel. But, okay, this is the happy part. But what about the rules and regulations? So you have RFS, you have R-factor and F-factor, which go into fuel economy and other calculations. NHTSA gives us our CAFE regulations. You have our CO2 footprint. You have fuel economy. What about those? So as Chris Grundler mentioned, there are, you have opportunities for higher blends based on the Tier 3 proposal. And it says you can certify this fuel if you can meet certain certain criteria, and it is a viable step to improving greenhouse gas performance, and that's right out of the Federal Register. So Gene McCarthy also said recently, "Yeah, we didn't get it right, did we?" So they're looking at, and as Chris mentioned, revising the RVOs potentially to maybe address some of the concerns of the people in the audience. But not so fast. Charlie Brown has a big fear of letters. Certain ones really get to him. Those. So he's very, very concerned about certain things, and Charlie Brown represents certain OEMs potentially. So the rules say you can optimize on a higher blend, says Lucy. Charlie Brown goes, great. The trouble is, when she pulls a football away, that's because you have to show the usage first. Now, I don't want to crib from somebody else's presentation who's about to have it, but this is the chicken or the egg scenario, and it's just, until that gets broken, we'll be having this discussion again potentially in 5 years. So we requested the EPA provide long-term regulatory consistency and leadership, and they've done to some extent, but to achieve the national goals of greenhouse gas reduction and energy independence, they could literally throw the switch and say, hey, guys, this is what you need to do. We think it's a great idea to optimize vehicles. Go ahead and do it, and we will dispense with some of the where we have baked in regulatory issues. So that's kind of the keys of the kingdom are held right here. So Theodore Roosevelt said, in any moment of decision, if the best thing to do is the right thing, and the worst is to do nothing. So we hope nothing isn't the answer. Another shameless commercial. That's a really neat car, the S-Class. It costs about half my house. And Mercedes-Benz, the best or nothing. Thank you very much, everybody.
I loved it. Things are always exciting when Bill Webkenberg is in the house. So we're very appreciative to have him and his talent leading the way for Mercedes in the United States. The next gentleman really needs no introduction. He is absolutely an advocate for this industry and is constantly providing leadership and thoughtful insight into how we can improve ourselves. So, Coleman Jones, General Motors.
Thanks, Christy. I guess I'm going to have a tough act to follow here, but I'll give it a shot. Okay. Many of you know ethanol is energy. Energy is important. Things that are important attract a lot of words, particularly in a major city on the east side of the U.S. But we're interested in other things, too. You may have heard that the automaker is a regulated industry. It's true. We are a regulated industry. And we pay attention to the regulations. We pay a lot more attention to the regulations than we pay attention to the words. Because these regulations are the deeds by which we have to live our business. And these have to be distinguished from the words that we hear. Let's see. So, we've all heard the words. Let's examine some deeds. We have fuel economy rules, greenhouse gas rules, the F factor, the R factor, Tier 3, RFS2, producer and infrastructure credits. Some of these you know more about than I. But let's examine them. This is a fuel economy CO2 outlook. For your inconvenience, we have converted this into the grams CO2 per kilometer using the European test cycle. But you can see that all markets are driving towards extremely low CO2 emissions, extremely high fuel economy. And although the U.S. appears to be less stringent than other markets, the U.S. has very stringent emission standards, which makes it difficult to implement diesels, which are a quick 20% improvement in your CO2. And also, the U.S. has market and regulatory barriers that prevent us from all driving Bill's little car known as the Smart. Because we have a footprint-based system, which is where if you shrink the car, the bar goes higher. Also, some of you might not want to have that as your only car. Let's convert this into units we're used to. So this takes the prospective fleet average CO2 values in the 2017 greenhouse gas rule and the 2012 greenhouse gas rule and converts it into miles per gallon. There's actually two rules, one covering cars, the other governing trucks. You can see I have illustrated the car that Bill doesn't drive, the Smart 4.2, which was the highest rated fuel economy gasoline-powered non-hybrid vehicle sold in the United States at 50 miles per gallon. Also, we have the Chevy Volt, which also returns about 50 miles per gallon when running solely on gasoline. You can see that hybridization buys you useful things like back seats and trunks. yes. Nonetheless, these cars will be average in 2021. 2025 is more challenging. And just if you think that going to Smart for Twos will solve your problems, the Smart for Two in 2025 actually has to return 68 miles per gallon due to its short wheelbase and narrow track. I won't go into the calculations, but let's just say that electricity does a little better, and I think this is the hint. There's a little hinting going on in the regulations. There's other things in the regulations, too. It's what we call flexibilities, or EPA calls flexibilities. And the flexibilities are, EPA's got pretty stringent requirements, but the flexibilities allow us extra credit because there's things that EPA wants us to do that are hard to capture in the traditional measurement system. They want us to go to low greenhouse gas refrigerants, improve air conditioning efficiency because the air conditioner isn't used in most test cycles, and other technologies that reduce real-world consumption but aren't measured in the way they do the testing. Alternative fuels have potential benefits. E85 can reduce tailpipe CO2 emissions by about 5%. CNG and diesel can reduce tailpipe emissions by about 20%. 20% is a big deal. Of course, the cost of diesels and CNG is a big deal, too. And then, of course, electricity doesn't have any CO2 emissions, so there's some attraction there. On a monofuel vehicle, it captures the entire benefit. So dedicated electric, dedicated CNG vehicle capture the whole benefit, as do electric dedicated E85 vehicles. Dual-fuel vehicles, you have to figure out how to apportion the CO2 between gasoline and whatever your alternative fuel is. The way EPA structured the rules, gas, CNG and plug hybrids are assumed to use natural gas and electricity to the maximum extent. Flex-fuel vehicles, on the other hand, are presumed to use gasoline. So, we've all been around a long time. We've all heard of the fuel economy standards that were implemented, and the 1970s from the Energy Policy and Conservation Act, and those are administered by NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And their volumetric standard, miles per gallon, must compensate for the lower energy content of alternative fuels relative to petroleum. So if I build a car that's 40 miles per gallon on gasoline and I run a fuel economy test on E85, I come back with 30 miles per gallon. Well, I certainly don't want to be reporting those numbers. I'm going the wrong direction. So NHTSA, using language outlined in EPCA, only counts 15% of the volume of the alternative fuel. So I divide my miles per gallon through by 0.15. And if I have a dedicated E85 vehicle that gets 40, that would get 40 miles per gallon on gasoline and gets 30 miles per gallon on E85, I divide by 0.15, turns it into a 200 mile per gallon vehicle. Wow, this is attractive. If I make a flex fuel, under the law, they assume that the vehicle uses flex fuel half the time. Using the harmonic average, this turns a 40 mile per gallon vehicle into a 67 mile per gallon vehicle. This structure, with its 50% usage assumption, is a strong incentive to build flex fuel vehicles. It's so strong, so attractive, that they capped it. We can only capture 1.2 miles per gallon. And this is why, historically, automakers only built about 10% of their fleet as flex fuel, because you could capture all the available credit by building 10%. In 2006, a number of automakers decided to go far beyond that, but that's the structure of the credit. However, this cap, starting in 2015, will decay. Year by year, it will fall by 0.2 miles per gallon until it reaches 0.2 miles per gallon in 2019. To capture that credit, you would build between 2 and 3% of your fleet. I don't think this is what they really wanted, but this is how it got written. And by the way, although these credits work in EPA world and through 2015, starting in 2016, these are applicable only towards your NHTSA obligation, because we are measured on fuel economy twice, once by NHTSA, once by EPA. For those of you who have done the alternative minimum tax calculation, there are similarities. So let's talk about EPA. EPA started regulating CO2, which is really fuel economy, in 2012. They use actual CO2, tailpipe CO2 reductions to measure alt fuel benefits. This is more straightforward, and keep in mind, EPA's goal is to reduce CO2 emissions, NHTSA's goal is to reduce petroleum consumption. So they have different goals, and they have different structures for doing this. E85 is estimated to be a 5% reduction in CO2 relative to gasoline. If I take my 40-mile-per-gallon car and convert it to the EPA world, which is a grams CO2 per mile, it turns into a 222-gram vehicle. I take 5% out, it goes to a 211-gram vehicle, which becomes 42 miles per gallon on E85. Utilizing a 50% usage rate, as NHTSA does, just for illustration, it turns into a 41-mile-per-gallon vehicle. You will notice that this 41-mile-per-gallon number is not as attractive as the 67 mile per gallon number I showed on the previous page. In addition, EPA presumes that we use gasoline. Now they said that if we can demonstrate the C85 usage, we can use the numbers. Now we can presumably use something on OnStar, called OnStar, to watch what people are fueling with. Our competitors will have to call the NSA. Alternatively, we can use a demonstration for the national E85 average, and I'm not going to soak up time by explaining that, but anybody who wants to know how it works, you know where to find me. And EPA outlined this national average use in the preamble of the 2012 through 2016 final rule. Now, starting in 2017, there's a new fuel economy rule, or greenhouse gas rule, that came out, and we all commented. Everybody in this room participates in an organization that commented. So let's review these comments. It was a big rule. There are lots and lots of comments, but I'm going to focus on the comments on ethanol and fuel economy and the like. So on the left, you'll see the request. In the center, you'll see the requester, and you'll recognize various organizations. And on the right, you'll see EPA's response. So there was a request to use the SAE calculation for usage, which presumes the usage of the alternative fuel. Okay, EPA declined to do that. The request was to use life cycle CO2 benefits. This is looking at the CO2 reduction that is accrues to ethanol because you use today's sun rather than the sun from 75 million years ago to make that fuel. EPA declined to do that, and there's a very good reason they did that. They've broken the economy up into blocks, and the upstream block is a different regulation called the RFS2. There's request to use the 0.15 divisor, which would have been really attractive, but they declined to do that. We requested that they use the RFS2 volumes. This is kind of the common sense approach. After all, the law states you're going to have the tsunami of ethanol. You need to do your calculation based on the tsunami of ethanol. In this line, you'll see the alliance, and that's the automakers. So there's a lot of folks requested this. EPA declined to do this, and clearly we should have paid more attention to EPA not expecting that the RFS2 would be implemented as written, because this was one of the first signs. Then there was request for E30, and at least in my reading, EPA didn't even address the request, which is unusual. Then there was a request to incorporate the RFS2 into the greenhouse gas, and I'm sure Jeff Cooper could recite the response to that. They declined to do that. So finally, we said we need early guidance, okay? If we're going to be building vehicles in 2016, we need to know ahead of time what they're going to be worth, because if we don't know what they're going to be worth, we'll spend the money on something that we do know what it's going to be worth. You can see EPA's response in the final rule. We still haven't gotten any guidance yet. So let's talk about guidance. F factor. Let me go back. Does this thing go backwards? All right. That 50% number you see in the middle of the slide, that's the F factor. So in the greenhouse gas rule, EPA stated they plan to make this assigned fuel usage factor available through guidance prior to the start of the 2016 model year. So in November 2011, the automakers went in and said, okay, what's the number? We laid out an approach to calculating the guidance in the 2017 rule. This was based on the premise that the EPA would enforce the RFS2 as, I had to change the language here, usually interpreted. In 2013, EPA issued a draft guidance letter and solicited comment. The draft guidance assumed a 20% usage of E85 and was based on a Monte Carlo model. What happens in Monte Carlo? The house always wins. That's right. So, with an F factor of 0.2 in the EPA calculation, this represents a 97% reduction in the benefit from building a flex fuel vehicle compared to the NHTSA calculation. And that NHTSA calculation didn't get a lot of offshore manufacturers to build flex fuel vehicles. So here's some challenges here. So almost all the comments were aligned and pointed to existing EPA models forecasting much higher ethanol usage. Guidance comment period closed in April 2013. I think if the guidance is based on the 2014 proposed RVO, it would be even lower than 0.2. Now, you thought that was fun. Let's talk about the R factor. EPA has an equation to calculate the fuel economy. This comes out of the Code of Federal Regulations, and it contains an adjustment factor circled in red. This is called the R factor, and it adjusts the fuel economy result for changes in test fuel energy content. A R factor of 1 is perfect adjustment, which means as fuel energy content goes up, the fuel economy goes up. An R factor of less than 1 means that the vehicle does not fully compensate for changes in fuel energy content. Now, as EPA states, the engine will be adjusted to comment for the energy content. This will be required either to maintain vehicle drivability or to maintain acceptable hydrocarbon and CO emissions. Doing otherwise would result in higher emissions of NOx if we went lean, or hydrocarbon and carbon monoxide if we go rich. However, we have a number of 0.6, which indicates the vehicles do not fully compensate. And this is based on data from 30 and 40 years ago on carbureted vehicles and on tests with fuels with higher than 1975 energy values. Ethanol additions reduce the energy content of gasoline. E30 was mentioned as a forward-looking fuel in the Tier 3 NPRM. However, an E29 has 10% less energy than gasoline and would result in 10% fewer miles per gallon in the EPA test cycle for a non-optimized vehicle. Using the EPA equation above, we would get 4% fewer miles per gallon. Well, why would an automaker willing to use a certification fuel that started them off in the hole? Why would you use a fuel that has less energy than the 1975 reference fuel? Bill, can you explain this? And I left my computer at Target, and look at what happens. All right. LEV III rules. Californians are sparse in this crowd. LEV III is a California emission standards. It will drive, is driving, fleet non-methane organic gas plus NOx requirements substantially lower than they are now. The vertical line is at 2014, where we are today. California had huge reductions in a few years ago. Got level, couldn't put up with that, so we're back on the downslide. This is the ratio. The lines don't exactly ratio, because on the left we have to demonstrate 50,000 mile durability. On the right, we have to demonstrate 150,000 mile durability. But let me put this into relevance, into your world. On the left, you can see three standard emissions levels. The one in the middle, that's where we certify our flex fuel vehicles. We try to do a nationwide cert at that level. The lower level is the PZEV level, and there are no flex fuel vehicles certified at this level. And the sole complaint I've gotten in my years was somebody bought a PZEV vehicle thinking it was going to be flex fuel, but couldn't be, not legally. On the right, you can see where we're going. And we are marching, is what we call the march to zero. We never get to the march to zero because they always change scales. But anyway, we're going down to this new level, and it's going to be a challenge. Now let's talk about this in Tier 3. These are the past Tier 1, Tier 2, and proposed Tier 3 levels. You can see on the left, that's where we were with Tier 1 back in 2001, 2003, 2004. And we had a big drop in emissions. In fact, those vehicles in the middle years, which includes this year, are actually, in some respects, cleaning the air as they drive around urban areas. But we need to improve. So notice the change in scale, where we go from the top being 1.75 to the top being 0.175. And you can see the further reductions that we will be executing. These emission standards are going to be very challenging. And E85 makes it very difficult to meet these standards. The certification fuel that we use is not representative of market fuel. Indeed, it is not even encompassed by Christie and I's ASTM standard. And we wrote comments that pointed out that EPA, in its effort to make certification fuels represent market fuels, should make the E85 certification fuel represent the E85 market fuel. We will see if that happens. Next slide is a new topic, and it's one of Bill's favorite topics, because Bill, did you say you were a chicken farmer? Anyway, we've been farming chickens and eggs in this business, and one question is how we implement a new fuel. And there's been a lot of talk about a high-octane, mid-level ethanol new fuel. And there's a whole coop full of chickens and a basket full of eggs, and we have to resolve these. And we've kicked around some ideas on how it could be resolved. And I know I've talked to this on this subject with a few of you in private. And we've tried to figure out, how do we get here? How do we get there? And you can line pretty much every automaker up and say, over there in the golden sunshine, we want to be there. And fortunately, we're here, and it's in Detroit, and it's 4 degrees, and there's ice falling from the sky. But we don't know how to get there. So these are some pathways, and I'm all ears if anybody's got some more pathways. But let's just talk about some ideas. Okay, so we'll call it the CERT fuel first pathway. So EPA creates a high-octane, super-premium certification fuel. Sit down, Bill. Don't get excited. Okay. And automakers optimize as much as they dare, knowing that 87-octane fuel is still available, and there's lots of people who just pick up the cheapest fuel and put it in regardless of what their AMG owner's manual says. And we will potentially capture some level of CO2 savings. Widespread introduction of vehicles tuned to this new fuel enable better performance to the new fuel. Fuel marketers respond to the expanding availability of the vehicles using this new fuel, simultaneously fulfilling their RFS2 obligations. Then we come to the second option, which I'll call market fuel first. And our view was that RFS2 would stay in place. This would produce a tsunami of ethanol. Proliferation of blender pumps would initially be targeted at flex fuel vehicles. Widespread available of high-octane blends encourages automakers to build vehicles that take advantage of this fuel. And this is completely customer-driven, all right? There isn't even a certification component in there until EPA catches up and creates a cert fuel. Then for what we call premium fuel first. And here OEMs certify on premium rather than regular. And we can do this today. Demand for premium increases, synergistic increases in vehicle octane demand and octane supply drive the market forward. These vehicles could be ethanol capable at higher costs. Most likely they would be. And this would increase the demand for ethanol. And we're on our way to the promised land. And finally, we have what's called raise the octane floor, which is where EPA just eliminates lower octane blends. This increasing this octane of all fuel will increase demand for octane. A new super premium can be created to achieve European and Japanese premium octane levels. More octane demand, more ethanol demand. It's a virtuous circle. However, we're kind of skeptical of these pathways, which is why I'm looking for alternative suggestions. For pathway one, EPA is focused on matching certification fuel and field fuel. That's why they want to go to an E10 cert fuel, so that the actual use of the certification fuel is high, because in currently the actual use of the certification fuel is pretty much zero. So I don't know how much appetite they have to create a new cert fuel that won't be used widely in the field right away. Let's talk about two. If we're going to do market-driven, in the end, we're going to have a pathway to certify on mid-blends. So EPA has to create a fuel that matches the field fuel. We need a mechanism which cars designed for high-octane mid-blends still operate with a consumer-acceptable way when misfueled on 87. And that's just not consumer, that's also NHTSA acceptable, because NHTSA weighs in on things like this. Three, improving going premium first. Well, I think you guys have noticed that premium is quite a bit more expensive than regular, and it's not offset by fuel economy improvements. This is a poor customer value. Premium pricing is currently higher than its incremental cost, but it's a low-volume product, so it probably should be a little higher. And then four, EPA raises the floor. EPA is reluctant to mandate market fuel changes. Raising the octane floor would certainly be betrayed by people who were speaking yesterday as raising fuel prices. So, again, these are pathways. You've got more pathways. We're all ears. So let's summarize. Let's look at the deeds. New fuel economy rules phase out credits for flex fuel vehicles. New fuel economy rules are, to borrow a phrase, have caused the automakers to focus like a laser beam on fuel economy. Because this is an existential issue. Greenhouse gas rules provide little values for flex fuel vehicles. The F-factor guidance is delayed and looks like it's not going to be of much benefit. The non-unitary R-factor in the fuel economy calculation really precludes the voluntary use of a certification fuel that has less energy than 1975 fuel. It puts us in the hole. Why would we sign up for that? LEV 3 and Tier 3, they're going to tremendously increase development, calibration, certification workload compared with unrepresentative certification fuel, and it's going to make FFEs difficult. RFS2, I think you guys know that story. I think you know the story about producer infrastructure credits, and I think you could probably add some more things to this list. And we have a pathway issue, and leadership is needed. We tried the E85 leadership route, and So far, we haven't seen a lot of traction. So, thanks for your time. Sorry, I'm not as entertaining as Bill, but maybe next year.
An important picture there is Charles Kettering, who was the head of GM Research for a number of years, and there's a university in the Detroit metro area after Charles Kettering University. Just a sidebar there. The next speaker, again, doesn't need any introduction. We're very lucky to have him off the slopes in Colorado to come talk to us about what is the National Renewable Energy Laboratory focused on, where are we going to go, and where are the benefits or drawbacks of ethanol.
Well, thank you very much, Christy, for the opportunity to be here. It's always fun to hang out with the ethanol industry. My charge today is to discuss some of the factors that may be driving higher blending levels of ethanol in the future, what some of these blends are, and how they perform in vehicles. Which button do I push? The green one, okay. So one of the biggest drivers is the need to significantly reduce greenhouse gas emissions. A number of studies have shown that in order to stabilize the climate, we need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by on the order of 80% by 2050. We do have some policies in place that are pushing us in that direction, but the key take-home message is that it requires, as Chris Grundler said earlier this morning, both improvements in vehicle efficiency and reduction in the carbon intensity of the fuel used by the vehicle. So the fuel economy and CO2 regulations that Coleman was just talking about are policies that are driving more efficient vehicles. And then the renewable fuel standard is driving the implementation of lower carbon intensity fuels. So this bar chart shows, roughly speaking, the renewable fuel standard requirements. The horizontal lines show what ethanol blend level those requirements would lead to if it was all ethanol. But we kind of seem to be stuck at about the E10 level, as I'm sure you're all aware. And some ways to get beyond that are possibly E15, greater use of flex fuel and flex fuel vehicles, and possibly also renewable super premium. And so I'll talk today about E15 and a little bit about renewable super premium. Several of the previous speakers, both in on this panel and the previous panel, have kind of set me up very well to talk about that. So as you're all, I'm sure, aware, EPA has granted a waiver for the use of E15 in 2001 in newer cars. This has proven to be very controversial, with a number of negative statements or statements about how E15 could negatively affect your vehicle being made in the advocacy arena, in the press, in television commercials. This situation, I believe, led RFA to come to us and essentially ask the question, if there is an issue with E15, we need to know about it. And we were charged with reviewing all of the published studies on E15 and E20 use in cars. I assembled a team of folks at NREL, myself, Dr. Janet Yanowitz, Dr. Brad Ziegler, and Matt Ratcliffe. I was just tallying up how long all of us together have worked in the fuels and emissions, engine design, combustion areas, and it's on the order of 75 years of combined experience. But these other three individuals hadn't done any previous work on E15, so they came to it with a very, very fresh approach. We reviewed 43 different studies. Tried to do a very critical review, and by that I mean we criticized a number of these studies because with our benefit of 20/20 hindsight and the ability to look at all the data, we thought that some of the studies had methodology that maybe wasn't as good as it could be, and some of those were even DOE studies that we criticized. This slide really tries to bring out what I think are two of the most important findings. The first is that 2001 and newer cars are able to adequately compensate for the oxygen content in the fuel, the added oxygen content at the E15 level. This means that the engine doesn't operate significantly hotter, that the emission control catalyst doesn't operate significantly hotter. This has important implications for engine durability because the engine's operating temperature is not substantially hotter. You're not expecting the temperature to cause durability issues. The second finding is from materials compatibility, where for both metals and elastomers, the studies show very little or even no differences in the materials effects of E10 and E15, or the slide says E17, because many of the studies used E17 as sort of a worst-case surrogate for E15. So after we had looked at all the data and were coming back around and taking a big-picture view of it, these two results stuck out to us as suggesting that based on these results, we shouldn't expect to see any negative issues with E15 and 2001 and newer cars. This seems to be borne out by fuel system component studies, studies of fuel pumps, fuel injectors, what have you. Fleet studies don't find any conclusive evidence of any issues with E15. There's also the CRC engine durability study. While we, in our review, we don't really single this out, it has been cited in some of the very negative comments made about E15, so I wanted to make sure and talk about it today. The study looked at 8 different engine models. These engines were removed from the vehicles, tested on a drive cycle intended to simulate 100,000 miles. The study design was to test on E20, and if everything was okay on E20, to just assume it was good on lower ethanol blend levels, which I think is a good assumption. There was a statistical analysis to try to determine some probabilities of what might be causing failures, and then the failure criteria. Emissions at end of test, EOT means end of test, diagnostic trouble codes, so did the check engine light come on, essentially, and then 3 criteria related to valve wear, the valve clearance, cylinder compression, and cylinder leak down. Now, my team and myself took some issue with some of these aspects of the study design and failure criteria. First of all, the drive cycle didn't reach very high engine speeds. We believe that reaching higher engine speeds is necessary for the valves to rotate in the valve seats and wear evenly. If the high speeds are not achieved, the valves won't wear evenly, and you could potentially have valve issues, valve clearance, compression, leak down issues. No E10 control fuel was tested. So if a engine failed on E15, it was then tested on E0. But we really strongly believe that E10, being the dominant fuel in the market by far today, should have been the control fuel. We were also critical of a DOE study for not using E10 as a control fuel. In the statistical analysis, the tests that were not run were used in the analysis, which gives the analysis a higher certainty than it would have. And also, one engine failed on all fuels, and those data were just tossed out, although that doesn't seem to be justified for us. And then with the test criteria, some of the older vehicles would be beyond EPA's defined full useful life. So we're not sure how good of a criteria emissions is for calling a failure. And then the leak down requirement of 10% is pretty low. The shop manuals for most of these cars don't really even bring out leak down as a standard to be met. But the ones that do cite a 20 or 25% leak down level. So these differences in opinion, perhaps, that we hold with CRC on how on the study design lead to a different interpretation of the data. If I start at the bottom here, the bottom box, really not counting for the moment the car that failed on all fuels or the engine that failed on all fuels. Only three engines failed on E15, two failed for leak down, which we don't believe is a useful criteria for failure. One failed on emissions. So one could interpret the data as saying there were no failures on E15. And also the CRC's study authors' statistical analysis concluded there was only a 7% chance that the failures were not caused by ethanol, but a reanalysis of the data using just the data and all the data suggests that that chance is more like 32%, which is a much greater level of uncertainty. So all of these studies taken together, certainly not just our discussion of the engine durability study, but all of the work taken together, leads me to the final bullet on this slide, which is the use of E15 is, in our opinion, likely to have little impact on 2001 and newer model year vehicles. So that's E15. I did want to talk a little bit about what it seems like everyone else has been talking about, ethanol blends that might be able to enable more efficient engines. So among the many approaches to increasing the efficiency of spark-ignited engines are increasing compression ratio, engine downsizing and downspeeding, and turbocharging. All three of these things make the temperatures and pressures in the engine much higher, so that a higher level of knock resistance or octane number is required by the fuel. The next technology is direct injection. When the fuel's injected directly into the cylinder, there's a number of different benefits, but one of them is that when the fuel evaporates, it cools the intake charge, so that brings down the high temperatures that you see from the other approaches to increasing efficiency. Ethanol has an advantage here, too. Just to be clear on what engine knock is, because I realize not everybody's an engine expert, and modern cars don't seem to knock that much, like maybe they did back in the 1940s or something. But knock is, octane number is a measure of a fuel's resistance to knocking. And knock occurs when the unburned gas, after the spark, the unburned gas ignites it, and this is gross oversimplification, but ignites ahead of the flame front, essentially all at once, like an explosion. It can cause damage to the engine. And when you increase the compression ratio, downsize, downspeed the engine, turbocharge the engine, you're going to increase the pressure and temperature, and if you don't change the fuel, you'll have a lot greater tendency to knock. So higher octane, higher knock-resistant fuel is required to enable these more efficient technologies. The benefits that ethanol has, which is really, I think, a unique combination of benefits, is first, the chart on the left shows the heat of vaporization of the hydrocarbon components of gasoline and different alcohols. You can see that ethanol, the chart calls it latent heat, but ethanol has roughly three times higher heat of vaporization than the hydrocarbon components of gasoline. So if you have a significant amount of ethanol in the gasoline in a direct injection engine, you get a much bigger cooling effect. Secondly, as you all know, ethanol has a relatively high octane number, and so the chart on the right from a study by Ford shows that the solid lines show that as you blend in this case, up to 30% ethanol, you can get about a 10 research octane number increase. But if you run this fuel, say the E30 fuel, in a direct injection engine, it behaves as if, because of the cooling effect, it had a research octane number of 110. So at the E30 level, this heat of vaporization benefit is worth something like 10 octane numbers. Now here I've used the E30 word. I don't think anybody knows whether this fuel needs to be E30 or whether it could be flex fuel, E51 or E40. Maybe it can be all of these things. Ultimately, I think what would happen in the market is that the fuel would be specified based on its level of knock resistance, and it could have a range of ethanol contents. But ethanol seems to me to be a fuel with really unique properties for enabling these technologies. So I think I will go directly to my summary slide, and which I'm not going to read to you, but I think there are paths forward to higher level ethanol blends in the market. Certainly for renewable super premium, I believe Coleman brought out the chicken and egg issue, which is really a critical issue. And Coleman, I have some people actually studying how we might overcome this issue, and I'd be delighted if we could call you on the phone sometime and have a discussion of these possible strategies. I think we can add a number of different approaches to your list. But anyway, thank you very much, Christy, for the invitation to be here. It's been fun.